and welcome to The Huntington Way. My name is Pearl Sunshine, and in today's episode, we are going to be focusing on what professional development looks like for teachers. And in a little bit, I'll be interviewing Kevin Honeycutt, who speaks to different schools around the globe to help them with professional development, and he currently lives in Colorado Springs. Many families who don't have personal connections to educators may be wondering what happens on those mysterious days where their kids are at home, either on a Friday or a Monday, but teachers still go into school for those professional development days. Well, sometimes, but rarely, those days are meant to be work days for teachers to work in their classrooms and get caught up on grading, inputting grades, and communicating with parents. Most of the time, though, teachers are expected to spend those days attending sessions and classes to become better educators. The idea of professional development days are great. Many careers have days like this or requirements for a certain number of hours needed to further their education in their field of work. This way, they stay up to date with the latest best practices and different information about their field. Most of the time, though, professional development days aren't done right. In the Teaching and Learning Conditions Colorado survey and a summary report of the survey conducted by Cambridge Education, professional development was one of the lowest rated areas in schools. 42.2% of educators that responded to the survey said that the effectiveness of professional development might not be assessed regularly or should be assessed more regularly. Reevaluating the effectiveness of these days is essential so that teachers actually get something out of it and they can grow and learn and get a little bit more personalized sessions. 36.6% of educators that responded to the same survey said that they have not received adequate professional development to support their students' social and emotional learning. And this becomes an issue not only because teachers are just responsible for delivering content and information to their students, but teachers are also partially responsible for making sure that students receive the best information and education regarding emotional intelligence. I will say that for District 20 in Colorado Springs, they do a pretty good job of incorporating that emotional intelligence into their schools, because that's a school, that's a district that I used to work for. And they started an initiative a few years ago called Capturing Kids' Hearts. That was a way for teachers to learn how to build social and emotional intelligence into their classrooms. But I will say not all districts and schools have those opportunities. In the Teaching and Learning Conditions Colorado survey, another piece of the professional development feedback that they got was that only 65% of respondents agreed that professional development opportunities are personalized and aligned to their needs and strengths. And this is significant because that means that 35% of respondents disagree and say that there aren't a lot of personalized and individualized sessions that align with their personal needs. So this, in some ways, is not setting a good example for what educators should do with their students. Ideally, teachers would be able to personalize and individualize their curriculum so that they meet the needs of all of their students. But if we're not seeing that consistently in professional development, then that becomes a little bit of an issue. In general, many teachers complain about the lack of work time that they have in their classrooms, and so that plays into professional development because most teachers don't necessarily have a voice when it comes to what happens on those PD days. In order for professional development to be successful, it needs to be engaging and not just someone presenting a boring slideshow, because that's not what we as educators want to give to our students. Instead, it does need to be motivating and relevant, and professional development should reflect what we all as educators should be doing in our own classrooms. And that is exactly what Kevin Honeycutt does when he goes to schools and presents this information and sessions to schools across the globe. And he does a great job of being motivating, relevant, and engaging with his audience. So here with me today is Kevin Honeycutt. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on the show. So I would love to ask you some questions about what you do when you go out and present to different schools. So could you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Oh, I was a teacher, K-12 art for 13 years. And after that, I was a school board member. So I've been in educational leadership for a long time, 30 years total. So in that job, I find out what the school needs, and that's not always easy. Sometimes they just want someone to fill a day. And I've had people say, just, you need to fill a day. I hate that. I don't want to be anyone's movie for 8 hours, and I don't think anyone should have to. What I want them to do is to dial me in. What do you need? What do your teachers need? What are your goals? Where do you want to be in 5 years? And then I calibrate what I'm going to do to what they've told me. I want to be dialed in, and it doesn't happen as often as it should. So a lot of times you have to guess based on body language and facial expressions, you know, is this engaging them? Because if I'm not engaging them, and you said it in the beginning here, that we want to teach, we want our PD to look like the way we want to teach. I totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. And so when you are presenting to schools, what are the main topics that you tend to cover?
Well, pre-COVID or post? Post, it's all about just getting our groove back. We are bleeding out educators all over the world. People are leaving the profession in droves. It's been a long go. And the things teachers have been asked to do have been nearly impossible. So I love teachers for hanging in there. But what I want to do is make them stay one more day. And this happens to me. I was in Texas and I'd finished my day with teachers. And this teacher comes up and says, can I drive you to the airport? And I'm like, okay. So he's driving me to the airport and he really opens up. And he says, I was going to resign this morning. And then I saw your keynote and I'll give it another year. Wow, who doesn't want to do that job, you know? So I feel like right now everything else is pushed aside and the main goal is just to get teachers to re-believe in the career they chose in the first place. And yes, give them tools, ideas, resources, motivation. But number one, just try to give them their belief back.
Right, yeah. And that is so important, especially now with COVID. These last couple of years, lots of teachers have been leaving the profession. So I think it's great that you're there to motivate them and inspire them. So after watching a number of your presentations, I've noticed that you talk a little bit about your childhood and your journey through poverty and trauma to find your light. And that is central to so many of your messages to students and staff. So what message would you give to students today who are trying to find their light?
I say the best way out of darkness is to make your own light. And so what I think we should do is allow kids to build things that make the world a better place, to go after their dreams in school, not wait till they graduate, and try to build things in that way. So part of my job is to find tools to let kids be authors or let them start businesses or in school while they're 16 or 14 or 13, instead of pretending it's all just sort of rehearsal for a show we're never going to do. You know, someone once told me if school taught basketball, first hour would be history and philosophy of basketball. Second hour would be proper inflation of basketball. And a master teacher, third hour, would let all the kids touch a basketball. But we'd never play basketball. Mm-hmm. And then when they graduate, you say, I hope you find a game. Well, how do we create a game while they're still in school in front of us? So, you know, I want to tell kids that the only thing that can stop you these days with all the tools we have is you. So what do you wish was true? And then let's get after it. Let's not waste time and wait for someone else to save us. Let's do it. And I've spent my whole life saying that and doing those things myself. So that's kind of, I think I answered your question.
Definitely. Yeah. And so that's something that you encourage also educators to do in their classrooms, right? Is to inspire students to kind of do those real world, activities or...
Let me give an example.
Okay.
Okay. So I meet a teacher in Wisconsin and he's amazing and he's a writing teacher. So the kids don't just write, they publish, right? So there's a site out there I show parents and kids called lulu.com where you can upload your manuscript or your PDF, choose cover art, click publish. And from that moment on, you have a legal copyright and global distribution. So now you have a book out there. So any kid can do that. So he does this with his kids. When he does assignments, he has them write things that are legit things people would read. Because in the past, if you wrote something in school, who read it? One person, the teacher. Mm-hmm. What famous author that you know of would have written any of their works for an audience of one? That is a non-motivator. But if I can get you published, and now suddenly you're thinking, this has to be good. I'm going to be a published author. If the only people at the school who are copyrighted published authors are the students, how cool is that? Mm-hmm. So I've done this with grade school kids, with picture books, with kids who don't want to write. And we just do pictures and do captions, or they speak a little piece about their picture and we record it with the phone, speech to text, put that under the picture and I catch them writing when they don't think they can. So there's all these ways now to sort of, and some people get mad. They'll say, that's cheating, you know, talking a book. How can you talk a book? And I say, is a wheelchair ramp cheating? We have new tools. Why are we waiting? What are we waiting for exactly? So yeah, I'm a big fan of let's get some tools and get some dreams and let's get started.
Yeah, that's great, really. And you've spoken and travel to schools all across the globe to help educators. So what would you say has been the most influential or profound travel experience for you?
Oh my gosh, Groot Island, and you'll have to Google this, GROOTEYLANDT for some reason, island. It's a 40-mile wide island, 30 miles tall, in the Bay of Carpentaria, Northern Territory, Australia. So whenever I say Australia, I become Australian. I can't help it. So we go in there and we're taking iPads in to Aboriginal populations on a funded grant. So, but I also see there are schools there for the people who mine magnesium on the island. They're largely English or Australian people with their kids, and they've got uniforms that looks very much like a school in London you might see. And the Aboriginal schools are very different, very different. I remember the first day I was there, the guy said, Kevin, point of information, half the dingoes on the island will bite you, but half won't. I'm like, how is that helpful? And they have these like huts with no doors, and there's all these realities that hit you. I said, what are all these slices on the door jamb? He said, machete marks. I said, come again. He said, from the last uprising. I said, come again. I didn't see any of this in the brochure. So what happened last night? And today there's sorry business, and that means no one's going to do anything or go to school in this part of the map. So it's all red, and there's a chance there'll be a reprisal at school, because the guy killed another guy with the Aboriginal spear. So there are pull-down doors. On a moment's notice, you can pull down the doors, get the kids inside, like a castle keep almost, right? Mm-hmm. So that's going on. You can't swim in the water. There's box jellyfish. You know, everything's trying to kill you. And there's these crazy teachers there that come from all over the world to teach these kids, and they love it. They're these adventurous teachers that still have that crazy in their eyes, you know?
Sure.
I fell in love with these people. I would call them pioneering, but the thing I want to see there more, because a guy said to me, Kevin, you're a white cloud, aren't you? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you float in, but you don't rain. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, it's true. And I see this, and I see this on reservation schools in the Dakotas. I see this in New Zealand with those populations, the Aboriginal populations, that largely the people that teach their children are all Caucasian, which means I think that there's no role for me, as I could never be a teacher because I've never seen a teacher that looks like me. So there's a mission there, mm-hmm. bigger than me. And I left Groot Island, but Groot Island never left me. And I know I'm supposed to go back there with a crew of crazies and try our best to reacquaint these kids with their dreams. You know, they speak the oldest language on Earth. They're over 30,000 years old. And this generation will probably be the last kids to learn their own language because they don't have to. They have Nikes. There's a contract, you know, with GEMCO to mine the magnesium so everyone gets a paycheck and doesn't have to do anything, and it's destroyed their culture. So that place left a big mark on me, and I know I have another mission somehow, and it might not be me. Maybe my mission is to find the right people to go there. Maybe, you know, I don't know. So that's one. I can give you 20 more. I have seen the most beautiful things, and I have seen things that would make you cry. But I think deeply about all of this, and it informs my work everywhere I go.
Absolutely, yeah. And when you were on Groot Island, did you still present your typical keynote, or did you make any adjustments, or you were just there to observe?
I tore it all down and started over because how do you know? What's the arrogance of taking 60 slides to people? You don't know what they need until you get there. Madeline Hunter said, people don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. And so when I got there and started finding out what the real issues were, man, I got back to the hotel, to the Dugong Inn, and spent the whole night just trying the best I could to honor what their real needs were based on the input I had received by listening. I did a lot of listening there because talk is arrogant when you don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's great that you took time to reflect and to readjust. Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I am here with Kevin Honeycutt, an educational consultant, and when we come back from our break, I will be asking him more questions about his efforts in financial literacy. Welcome back to The Huntington Way. I'm here with Kevin Honeycutt, an educational consultant living in Colorado Springs. And in this segment, I'm going to be asking him a little bit about his financial literacy education efforts. So thank you, Kevin, again for being here.
So much fun.
And let's switch gears a little bit from professional development to financial literacy. So in addition to going out and presenting to schools, you're also a big advocate for learning at home. tell us a little bit about your financial literacy efforts at home or elsewhere.
So let me frame it in, with regard to my childhood. So I grew up in poverty and was in foster homes and on welfare. My father was an alcoholic and a criminal. I'm just going to go all the way to honest here. And so I went to school in 20 plus states. And the thing that I know my family didn't have was financial literacy. We didn't know. If we had money, we spent it quickly so someone else didn't steal it. So we were perpetually broke. And so I didn't know what a mortgage was. I didn't know what escrow was. No one teaches this. At least they didn't then. You might have a home ec class and they teach you how to balance a checkbook. And that was the extent of financial literacy in my upbringing. Mm-hmm. So the biggest problem I had out of the chute was how to get a mortgage and how do you make, why is credit so important? And how do I get my credit higher? Now we have all these tools these days, but I still don't see a lot of teaching of this in school. And I don't know why, so I think there should be more. So I go to some places and they say, hey, we want to start a financial literacy, we'll call it an entrepreneur program. That's the best way I can get started with this, grade school to high school. So what we do is we let's pretend there's a business class. And to get into business class, you have to have a business plan. So you have to pitch that Shark Tank style even to get in the class. Now, in the class, your grade is based on income, actual income, money you make while you're in the class with your business you started in the class. Is that legal? I don't care. Because the places I go have no hope. They have no jobs. They have no whatever. And see, the thing today is I can start a store and sell online. I don't care where I live. I can sell globally from here right now or from Mule Lick, Nebraska, or from wherever. I happen to be Bertha Hewitt, Minnesota. So it's the wild places that let me come in and shake things up because there's no ego barrier. The closer you get to any state capital, the more arrogance you run into and the more impossible things suddenly become because everyone's a PhD that knows more than you. But give me the chance to go in there and work with kids and work with teachers. I can tell you 20 different ways to start a business today with no money at all, just your sweat equity and your intellectual property. So if you're in school and you write, all that writing is intellectual property. If you're in art class, all that art is intellectual property. If you're in photography, which we all should be because the new iPhone, it's amazing. But all phones are amazing now. They take great pictures, better than the Nikons I taught photography with when I was a photography teacher. So what's your excuse? Why aren't you taking great pictures and selling those pictures everywhere? You know, Redbubble, you can put that on, you know, 100, 200 different products and be selling tonight. Now go out there and use social media, find the people who love your genre and soft market to them and measure the response, right? This should be taught. Mm-hmm. Kids are doing puberty online, but they're not doing sales. They're not doing their dreams. They're messing up. They're peeing in the pool before they even know it matters, mm-hmm. right? So my message out there is let's get busy letting kids leverage these tools to build their own future. I'm not saying they're going to make $1 million on the first thing. Part of this is divorcing them from that lottery ticket notion that just because I have a song means I'm a millionaire. I published a book a few years ago. I've made a few thousand dollars on that book. But anymore, you know how many books there are?
A lot.
You'd be very lucky to make a lot of money on the book. Yeah. But the book gets me in to do a keynote. So it's a little more complicated than just, I wrote a book and I'm famous. That's cute, right? And I think sometimes schools, we teach that because we don't know how to really write a book. We're teaching business. But we've never had one. So I'm out there saying, you know, if you teach spreadsheets all day, it's like teaching the hammer but never building a house. Build a house. You'll learn the hammer, mm-hmm. right? So I've done this. I've actually helped set up programs like this. And it's hard because there's nothing to compare it to. And what happens when the kid graduates? How do you let them take their business with them and, you know, build their own life? And how do we do it in such a way that they don't – you know, you can have sales and have sales your product price too low and bankrupt yourself on the popularity of your product if you don't understand price margin. Mm-hmm. So I'm starting in grade school. Now, if I could talk about my little kid in the cocoa stand where you've been a customer once. I've got pictures to prove it.
Yeah.
We're constantly doing these things on purpose. We built a big old cardboard. We called it the Cocoa Cabana. So this is Gibson's Cocoa Cabana, my six-year-old. And so first thing we had to do is buy Swiss Miss and the marshmallows, and we kept a spreadsheet on what that all cost. Because I don't want him thinking every dime we make is profit. No, there's no way. I want him to understand that he gets his first nickel the minute we break, you know, into profit, into black and not red. So even at that scale, we only sell three products, right? Cookies, cocoa, and York peppermint patties, because the price margin, oh my gosh, you buy a $7 pack of those, you really are into it for 8 cents a patty, and you can sell them for 25. So that's pretty good. Right. That's a pretty good margin right there. So, and then someone online, because I'm talking to 64,000 people worldwide every day on my social media, someone said, oh, I'd love to buy a cup of his cocoa, but I don't live near there. I said, Gibson, let's start a Redbubble store just for the Cocoa Cabana. They can buy a hat. Price margin on a hat is like $10 per unit. It's better than everything you sell. So immediately, you know, and I've got a business plan on my website that people can download. Moms and dads, you can have it. I'm not acting like it's something great, but it's something a six-year-old can understand. Mm-hmm. And I show pictures, a lot of pictures of what the products look like. And then I do the math underneath because really he's learning that math right now. So it's a perfect time to get him really comfortable and feeling just proud of himself as an entrepreneur. Here's the thing. He thinks every kid gets to do this. He thinks if he goes to public school, he's going to get to keep going. And you're a teacher.
Yeah.
Do you think that's going to happen for him? Right now, the way things are.
Right. Yeah. I think over time, it'll be really tough.
So if they have a makerspace and the right kind of educator in there and support, we could do it. So I want them to call. Call and let me come in and let's build it. Let's build it. It doesn't have to be perfect. Perfect is the enemy of done. Start. Just start. And it's going to take 3 or 4 years to get this off the ground. Parents aren't going to understand at first that, you know, when she comes home with a check that for $15 and that's her profits from a class she has in third grade. To me, that's a victory. That's a big, cool day, right? That I made something people want, number one. And two, I can do this again. Oh, yeah, you can do it again the rest of your life if you want to.
Yeah, and I feel like when kids start learning this at such an early age, like 6 years old or even earlier, they're more confident when they are brought out into the quote-unquote real world and need to do this all by themselves, right? They have those tools by learning through experience in order to be successful later.
And there are alignments. Okay, let's say you want your 16-year-old to get this business plan and make his own something. We can do that. Let's say that your first grader is learning to count money. Perfect cash register time. You know, to put the cocoa out there, put the marshmallows in, and then count the money. I've been to the convenience store with a 20-year-old I can tell she doesn't know how to count money back to me. You know what I mean? Or if the machine doesn't do it for her, she doesn't know how those basic things. I'm not saying we have to go back in time to a quaint time when we had old timey cash registers, but there's something about the reality of giving a customer back their change and getting it right while they're looking at you and handing them a product that's worth what you charged. Getting that built, inculcated, if you will, programmed into their head. So as they grow up, what I don't want is, now he goes to second grade, no, and there's nothing. And the third grade, there's nothing. Fourth grade, there's nothing. And for years, he just doesn't do it again. You know, it's like learning a language and not using it, you lose it. So I want him to have routine experiences with financial literacy and other kids too.
Yeah.
I go to Flint, Michigan. I talk to parents in the toughest places and there's no hope. And I'm like, man, we could do something great here. You know,
So
I'm kind of chomping at the bit to get out there and do more.
Absolutely. Yeah. As you should. Okay. You helped Gibson set up his Cocoa Cabana. Mm-hmm. You've helped other kids in schools with those efforts. What about parents who may be working full time, don't necessarily have time at home to help their kids set up something like a Cocoa Cabana? What are some quick, easy ways for parents to include financial literacy learning at home?
You know, we do stores. When you got little kids, they'll say, I want to do a bakery, or I want to do a store, a restaurant. They'll make a menu. All those moments, it's like they want to, you know. So in those moments, when you have that time, or get together a parent group that will do a little, let's say a farmer's market in your neighborhood right there on the weekend. Mm-hmm. And they could sell Play-Doh sculptures or whatever they want to do. So it doesn't have to be full-on legit to be good practice. So I'd say get together with other willing parents, and with the goal of helping your kids come out of that with some more financial literacy they went in with.
Okay, yeah. That sounds doable, right? Mm-hmm. I think so. Okay, well, thank you so much for being here. We're about out of time, but where can people find you online? How can people reach you if they have questions?
Mm-hmm. So it's Kevin, Kevin, HoneyCutt, kevinhoneycutt.org. And all my resources. Click the resource link at the top. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on YouTube. It's always going to be Kevin Honeycutt. So I invite people to follow and hit me up. Hit me with a DM and say, hey, what were those things you were talking about? And I'll send it to you.
Okay.
I'd love to.
Great. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, this has been The Huntington Way. My name is Pearl Sun and Shine, and we'll see you next time.